This is Kenya Beard, one of the co-producers of HealthCetera, brought to you by the Center for Health Policy and Media Engagement at the George Washington School of Nursing. On today's show, we will discuss the four dreaded words that no one ever wants to hear. You have breast cancer. The fear of breast cancer is real. It is the most common invasive cancer and is the second leading cause of cancer-related death. Breast cancer attacks approximately 1 in 8 women, and according to the American Cancer Society, over 250,000 new cases will be diagnosed this year alone. But so many women are living longer than ever before. So why is that? Here to help us understand why that is Dr. Ted James. Ted is the chief of breast surgical oncology and co-director of the Beth Israel Deaconess Breast Care Center. He is a faculty member of Harvard Medical School and serves as vice chair of academic affairs in the Department of Surgery. Ted has helped scores of women navigate the complex treatment decisions and challenges that often accompany a cancer diagnosis. Ted, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kenny. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Ted, currently there are over 3 million women who have breast cancer. And according to the American Cancer Society, before we delve into some of the statistics, what can you tell women who do not want to hear the words, you have breast cancer? What can you tell them about some of the factors that actually contribute to the incidence of breast cancer?
That's a great question. Fortunately, there are things that women can do to reduce their risk, Kenya. We have a lot of data that shows that lifestyle choices can have influence on someone's risk for breast cancer. We're seeing data where women who are physically active, who limit their amount of alcohol intake, and who have diets that are rich in fruits and vegetables, whole grains, will have a decreased incidence of breast cancer. We also have known for a long time that things like taking hormone replacement therapy, especially if it's prolonged, will increase the risk of breast cancer. So that's another decision that women can make to help to reduce their risks. And then on top of that, women just basically need to know their histories and know their risks. We're learning now there's a lot of genetic influences for breast cancer, and women who are able to identify that they may be at risk for an inherited mutation can get tested and then take appropriate preventative measures to decrease the likelihood of them developing breast cancer. And I think that's really a great thing where someone could be genetically predestined to have a breast cancer, but take steps to prevent that.
So what is it? I heard you say that hormonal replacement therapy can increase the risk for breast cancer. What is it about hormonal replacement therapies that does that?
Well, we think it's the interplay between these medications and the body's old physiology and endocrine system. And a lot of the hormone replacement therapies will stimulate estrogen. And we know that estrogen stimulation is one of the risk factors that can lead to breast cancer. So what we see is that women who are on prolonged doses of hormone replacement therapy, not just a short course during menopause, but for many, many years or longer than a decade, will have an increased risk of breast cancer. As a matter of fact, some of the combination hormone replacement therapies will increase the risk by about 75% in only 2 to 3 years.
Wow. So when we talk about estrogen, do women who or women who take birth control pills, should they be concerned also?
You know, the birth control pill data really hasn't panned out to the same degree. So I'm much less concerned about someone who takes birth control pills than I am as someone who's taken prolonged hormone replacement therapy.
Okay. And what about some of the incidences of breast cancer? We see that depending on your age, if you're over age 50, the rate of breast cancer is highest for white women. But we see that African Americans experience a higher mortality. What are some of the reasons for that disparity?
Yeah, it's a very interesting phenomenon, isn't it? So we feel that part of the problem is with access to care. You know, the other thing that we've noticed that there are some genetic differences, but when you look at the data, the genetic differences are responsible for a much lower degree of the disparity that we see. And the overwhelming factors that lead to this are things like access to care. Unfortunately, there is a gradient between the social economic status and the likelihood of getting screened, getting timely treatment. And it really is a big problem in our society. And I think it's something that we need to address beyond just the medical realm, but really look at our society and see where are these inequalities happening, why are they happening, and what can we do as a whole to address them? Because that, I think, will be necessary to really help making sure that every woman has timely access to high-quality care.
So I'm glad you brought that up. Access to care is huge, and I think it's so important for women to understand how the Affordable Care Act helps to increase access and some of the laws that have come about because of the Affordable Care Act. What can you tell our listeners about the ACA and access?
You know, there's been a lot of research on this area, Kenya. I think a lot of people are investigating this, especially with the potential changes that have been proposed. So what we know from the research and from observation is that there are prevention factors that were in the ACA that really helped increase access to screening. So, for instance, the no-cost breast cancer screening, the free genetic counseling, the fact that there were no coverage limits and no denials for pre-existing conditions. This really all cumulatively led to more women being able to have access to screening. And the data shows that there was a large increase in women who were screened as a result of the mandates in the ACA.
So now that more women are being screened, are we seeing different groups, based on race and ethnicity? Are we seeing a higher rate of breast cancer now that there's more screening?
Well, not so much a higher rate, but what we're really seeing is that the stage is different. So with the improved access to screening, we're seeing that more and more women of all socioeconomic and ethnic groups are having earlier stage of breast cancer diagnosed. And as we know, with earlier stages, we can get much better outcomes.
Definitely. So are we seeing better outcomes for groups like African Americans who have a higher mortality? And I think Latina women as well, right?
Yeah, there's been a lot of data looking at these various groups, the economic groups as well. We're making some progress. I think some of the disparity gap we've been able to address with social programs and programs like Nurse Navigators and advocacy and awareness programs, but there still is a demonstrable difference in survival between these groups. So although we've made some progress, there's still a lot that needs to be done. I think having access to screening, access to prevention, tools that the ACA affords is one step in that direction.
Can you tell us a little more about the Nurse Navigator?
Sure. So the Nurse Navigator rule has been greatly beneficial for women with breast cancer. Originally started in the Harlem Hospital with Dr. Freeman, who noticed that there were a group of women, the population of mainly low-income Black women, who had a significantly higher mortality in breast cancer compared to the national average. Many more of these women were dying of breast cancer than their national cohorts. And he also found that these women were presenting with much, much later stage of disease, very rare for them to have early stage breast cancer. So he initiated this program, this navigation program, to help women get access, to help reach out into the communities, to help spread awareness about early detection, about the resources that were available, to look at what are the barriers, whether it's transportation or time off from work, and ways in which the literally could navigate the system to get the care that they needed. And what they saw is after a number of years with this program that the survival rates started to equalize in this population and more women presented with early stage disease. So you know, that was just a perfect test case to show what the impact of addressing these type of barriers can have on a population that is unequally burdened by disease.
Wow, that sounds great. So definitely we need more of that.
No, absolutely. So since then, navigation has really taken off. I'd say many centers now incorporate navigation. National societies like the American Cancer Society supports patient navigation. So we're seeing this more and more. And it's not just in certain ethnic groups or social income, certain income levels. We're seeing that there's a benefit across the board for navigation because cancer care has become so complicated that it's often very difficult for an individual in the midst of dealing with their diagnosis to have to navigate this complex system. So having someone who could be your point person to help you through your appointments and scheduling with the other parts of the multidisciplinary team, keeping you updated on your results and tests and things like that, really has been a benefit for all women. So it's interesting that, you know, it was born out of a disparity, but by addressing that, it's benefited all patients.
That's great. I mean, anything that can help decrease the level of stress that women have to go through. And I don't want to keep saying women because I know breast cancer occurs in men as well. Mm-hmm. But this nurse navigator role, I think it's critical to help decrease that stress load and to help women, like you said, go through this very difficult period of time, feeling as healthy as possible, because we know that stress can make the disease worse and the outcomes worse.
Absolutely. It can definitely impact quality of life in a very negative way. So we've even seen here in our own experience at Beth Israel that the nurse navigator has been highly praised by the patients, definitely improves their total experience of care.
Nice. So women should get screened every year, we know. And there's different things out there, different organizations saying when it should start, how frequently it should be. Can you clarify for us? I know the ACS recommends annual breast screening with mammograms for women age 45 to 54, but what else should we know about screening?
Yeah, you know, it's really is a controversial area, and I think the bottom line is that women should realize that they need to make an individual choice about screening. I think it's important for women to realize, you know, what are the benefits of screening and then what are the harms of screening, and then make an informed decision for themselves based on where they weigh their priorities. I think the decisions for screening need to also be based on individual risks. So we have some women who may have certain family histories, genetic predispositions, or other biological findings, such as atypical ductal hyperplasia, that increases the risk for breast cancer. And that should weigh in heavily as well to their decisions in terms of when to start screening and how frequently to screen. Other than that, just making sure that women are being screened at a high-quality imaging center and getting the best possible diagnostic imaging and interpretation by a certified radiologist is very important as well.
So you're really saying don't wait to 45. That 45 is like a general age
range. I'm saying it depends. It depends on individual's history. It depends on concerns about the risk of having a callback or a biopsy versus the risk of maybe not finding a cancer as early as possible. I think these are discussions that women should have with their physicians and, again, come to an informed choice. I don't want to weigh in terms of where my biases might lie or how I interpret the data. But what I do strongly think is that the good thing that has come out of all this controversy is that people are realizing that we need to listen to the patients, have conversations with women, inform them, and have them part of the shared decision-making process of how to go about screening and prevention.
I like that. And you're right. Women should be part of that shared decision-making. It reminds me what we do with men with prostate screening and allowing them to determine whether or not it's time for them to be screened. I think that's critical.
Yeah, and so, in prostate cancer, that goes even further into the treatment options, surgery versus radiation versus watchful waiting. So I think we can learn a lot from that shared decision-making process and apply a lot of that towards breast cancer as well.
Do you think some might argue and say, well, it's different with prostate cancer because, it's more slow growing?
Well, there's a variety. So just like there's less aggressive and more aggressive variants of prostate cancer, we're seeing that with breast cancer as well. I think we're starting to learn more and more how to differentiate which ones are less aggressive versus more aggressive. And all that needs to be taken into consideration in terms of screening, treatment, and long-term surveillance. And I think the research is starting to give us more information about how we can do that. And I think we're moving into this whole new era, Kenya, of more tailored medicine, where we're not trying to come up with a one-size-fit-all set of recommendations, but we're really looking at the individual, looking at his or her specific features of their disease, their health status, their genetics, and their priorities and preferences, and then coming up with a treatment plan that really meets their individual needs.
It sounds like it's moving towards that more individualized approach, and that's great. Do we know in women who are more at risk for the more aggressive types of cancer, breast cancer?
Well, we know that there are certain genetic predispositions, such as the BRCA gene mutations, that do lead to can lead to a more aggressive form of breast cancer. We know that there are certain groups of women who are at higher likelihood of carrying these genes, and when they're identified, we can actually do genetic testing to see whether or not they carry these genetic features. So that's just one example where we can start to understand more about the individual and tailor the appropriate care based on their particular features.
That's great. And you sound like the ideal provider. But what about women who, and I say that because I'm sure that I'm going to get emails from women who are going to say, well, I had a provider and I did not feel like I was part of the shared decision making. I feel like I was told to do this and told to do that, and I didn't feel like I had a choice in the matter. Mm. What can we say to women who feel that way?
Well, I would say that's unfortunate, because I really do feel that we have better outcomes when patients are involved to the level that they want to be involved with. And it's really one of the principles about patient-centered care and shared decision-making. Part of the process needs to be assessing how much the patient wants to weigh in with the decisions. I mean, some patients are more than happy to have the doctor make the decision for them. Others want to be truly partners in the decision-making process the entire way. And I think that it's important for us to assess that. So I would just say that for individual women or people in general going in for care, to voice their concerns, to have these conversations with their physicians and let them know what would work best for them for their style of care. And hopefully they'll have more and more physicians who are adopting these principles and practices.
Yeah, that would be ideal. So you talked earlier, you alluded to the fact that there are screening options and that there sometimes are potential harms related to the screening. Can you talk a little more about some of those potential harms?
Yeah, I think the biggest ones that are mentioned are the risk of false positives. So if you're going to screen a population or screen an individual for that matter, there's a likelihood that you will find something, and that thing that you find ultimately will not be a cancer, which is wonderful. However, in the course of determining that, it may require additional imaging. So you might get called back for more imaging, which can be a very stressful experience. You may require a biopsy, which again is an invasive procedure. At the end of the day, the final result might be negative, but you've gone through a lot to get that negative result. So that's one of the downsides that they speak about for screening. And we have to offset that with the risk of missing disease early, right? And that's kind of where we are right now with screening. The other thing that we're realizing is that with screening, sometimes we do find something. It's a true positive. We find a cancer, but it may be a cancer that, interestingly enough, would not progress to disease, would never cause harm to the individual. And again, this gets back to what we're talking about in terms of some of these cancers are very slow growing and may not have the capability to ever reach a point where they'd spread to other organs or cause any kind of damage. We're just now in the infancy of really understanding the biology, the tumor biology in breast cancer, to try to differentiate that. So unfortunately, right now, we're treating all cancers relatively aggressively, usually with surgery and other means. But I think more and more, we're going to be getting to, again, a more customized approach where we'd be able to identify a cancer, but identify that this is a slow-growing, a more indolent cancer that may not need the full spectrum of treatment.
Okay. It sounds like years ago when we had that shift from almost all women having radical mastectomies.
Very much so. And, you know, if you look at the history of breast cancer, it's really the history of less is more. You know, surgery certainly has transformed substantially from the radical mastectomy that you described to lumpectomies. We're seeing the same thing with more minimal assessment of lymph nodes that don't require removal of all lymph nodes. More and more patients that I'm treating now are foregoing radiation or only getting partial radiation. We're seeing less and less chemotherapy, especially with earlier stages of disease presentation, and using other targeted therapies like tamoxifen and aromatase inhibitors. So it's really been fascinating just to see this this real shift towards more minimal treatment, which is been great for patients in terms of better quality of life, better function. And again, if anything, the survival has actually been increasing because these new advances, these new discoveries are so much more targeted and more effective than what we had before.
Yes, that's great that the survival rate is increasing. When I read that over 3 million women are survivors, that's pretty profound.
It is. It is. It's a great thing, actually.
So if a woman's diagnosed with breast cancer, what are like the top three things that you can think of that you would want that woman to know?
That's a good question. I think number one, she should know that she has options. This gets back to what you're saying before. I don't think that women should feel that they didn't have a choice in their decisions, that they were just told that this was the course of treatment that they needed, and they weren't really given options to explore other treatments. So I think the first thing for women to know is that they have options. Now, they may not always have every option available, depending on things like the size of the tumor or certain features of the cancer, but certainly the discussion should really be a list of options of how one might approach the cancer. And again, taking very strongly into consideration what the patient's preferences are and their priorities. I think number two, women should know that, at least in my view, treatment really is better when it's done in a multidisciplinary or team-based setting. You know, I find that when you have the surgeon and the medical oncologist, the radiation oncologist, the pathologist, the radiologist, the nurses, the social support team, really all working together, you get better outcomes. We're more able to address all the patient's concerns.
You just rattled off so many providers. This truly is multidisciplinary.
It really is. It's a team-based effort in this.
So are you saying they all should be ideally in one geographic location?
Ideally, if possible, but if not possible, that they should all at least be virtually connected, right? So that the patient, every patient who's being treated has the appropriate access. Now, not every patient might need every element of that multidisciplinary team, but having the team working together and available for patients who need the various aspects of that team-based care is going to lead to a much better outcome than any one clinician can provide by themselves. So I think that team-based multidisciplinary care is vitally important. And then you asked for three. So I think the third thing that I'd like women to know is that experience matters. We're seeing more and more studies that show that the experience of the treatment team, the volume, the number of cancers that they see each year has a direct correlation with the quality of the outcomes. It's kind of intuitive, right? But if you see, you know, 10 times more of a particular condition than someone else does, you know, your processes, your systems, you're going to have better outcomes. So looking for that volume, that experience is really important as well.
Okay, so what I'm hearing is three things that women should definitely know their options. Look for center where there's team-based care, because I think I agree with you when there's a team approach and everyone's on the same page, the communication tends to be a little better.
Exactly.
And then three, the experience matters. And I agree that experience matters. But what happens when you have new providers coming out? What do we do with them?
Well, again, the benefit of them working in a multidisciplinary team, right? So it's not the experience of each individual. It's one of the examples where the sum is greater than, or the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, right? The whole is greater than the sum of the parts, where if the team has experience, that actually rises the quality of each individual member, even if someone is coming on who doesn't have as much experience as the rest of the team. I also think that one of the things that we can do here, though, and you know, I don't want to give the wrong impression here. I think one of the things that we have to understand, though, is that not every patient may be able to receive their care at a specialized, high volume, multidisciplinary breast cancer center. I mean, that would be ideal, but I think realistically speaking, if we look about geography of this country, not everyone is right next door to a major cancer center like that. But I think it's important, though, is that we as clinicians need to look at, well, what are the best practices? What are the guidelines? What are the standards of care that are going on at these centers? And how can we implement them regardless of where the patient goes for care? So I just wanted to give that clarification as well.
No, and that's important. That's important. And I know you said also, those are the top three, but women should also know that the Affordable Care Act has helped to make prevention possible. It has increased and made it mandatory for insurance companies to pay for genetic counseling, free preventive counseling, detection, screening, no copay or deductibles for mammograms, no coverage limits, which is huge for women who have breast cancer. Because again, when you rattled off all of these providers who are part of that multidisciplinary team, everyone comes with a fee. And it's important that we have insurance that helps us pay for some of these the costs of care and treatment. And then again, the whole not having to worry about being denied coverage for pre-existing conditions is another part of that ACA that has benefited so many women. And I think that's so important. So do you have any concerns regarding the ACA repeal with breast cancer?
I do. And they come specifically with these mandates for prevention that you just so eloquently described. I mean, the evidence is clear. We have seen that women who have access to appropriate care will have better outcomes. And women who cannot obtain that access will present with later stage disease, and that will decrease their survival. I mean, women will die if they don't have appropriate access and timely access. So, you know, whatever evolves in our healthcare reform or healthcare transformation, I think we need to look at elements of things that are working well and make sure that we retain those elements as we as we roll out new policies. And, you know, we have a term in medicine called evidence-based medicine, right? Where we make clinical decisions for patients based on evidence. We look at the literature, we looked at clinical trials, we look at real evidence to say what works and doesn't work so that we can make the best decisions. I think we need to look at evidence-based policy as well. As we're making decisions that affect the health of our population, we need to look at the data to help inform those decisions, so we can make the right decisions to maximize health and well-being of our population.
So that's important. I mean, we talk so far about who's at risk, the importance of screening, the different treatments that are out there, and how the ACA has helped to improve outcomes. But what are we currently doing to prevent breast cancer?
Another good question, Kenya. So I think as we start to understand more and more about the causes of breast cancer, we'll do more and more in terms of being able to prevent the disease altogether. I mentioned before about the genetic factors. We have a trial at our hospital at Beth Israel Deaconess that's looking at a national genetic testing study to identify women at high risk and to get them access to genetic testing. If we can find that someone has a gene that predisposes them to breast cancer before they actually develop the breast cancer, that's an opportunity for us to intervene and to change their course. So I think that's a very important study, and it's a very important way that we can prevent cancers from even happening. We know that high-risk women, We know that high-risk women have options. There are medications that they can take that will reduce the risk of breast cancer in half, which is incredible. For more advanced risk women, there's a prophylactic surgery that can decrease the risk from 95 to 99%. And again, we can really change the course for women who've been identified at high risk. And then, you know, the other things we talked about in terms of the lifestyle, in terms of how active we are, things that we put into our body, that also has an impact on preventing breast cancer.
That sounds great. And we are running out of time. I want to thank you again, Ted, for joining us and sharing your expertise on this subject. I want to remind our listeners that prevention and early identification are critical ways that we can change breast cancer statistics and improve outcomes. Ted, thank you for sharing with us the importance of limiting alcohol intake and eating fruit and vegetables, getting screened, and linking up to centers that offer a multidisciplinary team-based care approach, and to make sure women know that they should be part of the shared decision-making up to the extent that they want, that they get to dictate that. And that came out loud and clear from our conversation. I want to thank you for emphasizing that. Is there anything that you want to share with listeners before we close out?
Yeah, one more thing. And Kenya, that was an excellent summary of all the points. Thank you. I'd like the listeners to know that, you know, they can really be active participants in everything that we're talking about here. And I think there are a lot of opportunities for women to get involved with advocacy, for helping to fund research for cures, and really getting involved with helping other patients and being a resource to help with education and outreach. There's so many opportunities that can be done, and I just like to see more people get engaged in these topics and making sure that we can do the best that we can for all women at risk for breast cancer.
Oh, thank you so much, Ted. And I just want to just echo that and remind our listeners that Ted is the Chief of Breast Surgical Oncology and Co-Director of the Beth Israel Deaconess Breast Care Center. They can find you online. What's the name of the link if they want to go to your website and find out more about your center?
Yeah, they can enter any major search engine and just put in Beth Israel Deaconess Breast Care, or put in my name, Ted James, at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, and that should bring them to our site with all of our information.
This is great. Thank you so much.
Well, my pleasure, Kenya. Thank you.